Good afternoon. Lena Life is back. I'm Lena Milmont with a very special guest, and I will break the mystery in a second. But before, I wanted to follow my sincere tradition to thank BBS for being such a wonderful, outstanding internet radio, which goes way beyond just being a radio station, for its resilience, and I would say receptivity to us hosts, and such a sometimes extreme in diversification of human issue. I'm particularly thankful today because indeed I cannot imagine a more diversified guest I'm having today. His name is Erhan Devravay, and I'm particularly very privileged to have him as a guest because I'm going through wonderfully inspiring creative difficulties to introduce this person. And I like to make a few points before I will be enthusiastically invite him to speak with all of us. And I like to say that it is something which I'm sure thinkers and philosophers of a previous times, maybe even as far as a couple of centuries ago, would not mind to have Erhan Devravay as their intellectual and spiritual partner. At the same time, what is incredibly fascinating, I felt learning about his life and especially about his most incredible documentary, that his eyes, his soul, his internal freedom, and freedom of intellectual and spiritual choice is so relevant for our modern society. I believe that trying to touch his world and having enough power to follow in his world, we will have at least some answers, not only how to develop our world, but how to preserve it in its best nature. I like to invite my guest with his self-introduction, because frankly, it is so colorful. It is beyond being exotic in its shape and form. It is filled with most constructive and very contrasting contrasts. And I'm repeating myself for the reason, because the only clear word for his life, I would say it's trans-dimensional life. I think I'm even creating a new word. But on this note, I will invite my dear special guest, Erhan. I hope he will not mind me to call him by his first name. And I just will ask you to share with us whatever is dear to your soul, whatever is conquered your imagination, and we will take it from there. Briefly, introduction will lead to some discussion of your life and documentary. Roughly, we will do half and half with our usual interactions with a piece of music. Erhan, you on?
Thank you very much, Lena. You used an interesting word, transdimensional. In 1992, I was living in British Columbia, and that's where I'm talking to you from now. And I had a very unusual, a truly unusual experience that created the name that you have been pronouncing rather well, Erhan Devravay. Since I was born in Scotland, we usually pronounce CH with a huh sound. So it is Erhan Devravay. And at that time, my wife and I created a Japanese language news bulletin that would be sent every month from Canada to Japan. And it was called Transdimension Vista. And we know that vista means a view, something that we see, and we know that trans means across or beyond. So literally it meant views from beyond this dimension, which gave it a tone and a topic all at once. It defined it as a magazine about evolution, about consciousness, and specifically about where we are now in our process of evolution as a species. So very briefly, I was born in Scotland. I traveled extensively from my late teens until the time I arrived in Japan in 1974. By the time I had arrived in Japan, I had already been on a pilgrimage through 75 countries. I was in search of core information that would help me to connect with many spiritual and philosophical traditions. But when I arrived in Japan, I really felt that I'd found the Holy Grail. Here was a country that could provide me with an ancient cultural perspective, an incredible training system called Zen, and a language difficult enough that it would probably take me decades to master, which is true. And from that time, in 1974, I have been connected with Japan and have continued my work as a researcher, a writer, a filmmaker, and I suppose the core job, if you could call it that, has been public speaking and communicating through various media. So that's it in a nutshell, Lena. I hope that's helped.
Helped a lot. And I like to summarize a little bit on emotional level.
Yes.
And to ask you to help me in this case to connect those abstract, very powerful, religiously beautifully oriented dimensions into our everyday life, considering that many people do share different religious roots, and yep, it is incredibly powerful right now. It is like a chaos of beliefs, people's search, and it's not only tremendous problems I'm talking about, an instinct of survival, which we will touch later talking about your documentary. But what I'm trying to express that reading about your life journey, I will say that literally every individual can find its own little or bigger space or place and feel comfortable enough to expand and to enrich their system of beliefs and bring it right directly to their soul, right directly to their everyday life with a tremendous craving to improve their life. So I do not want to narrow down your life achievement as a book or at some kind of lecture of best living or lecture for having some kind of emotional hygiene. No, I'm very much far away from it. What I like to say that indeed, in your documentary, one would feel tremendously strong desire with your sincere and very natural power of conviction, open another door, find its own, maybe again, narrow, but very progressive path to the improvement, either to relieve the pain, to honor the pain, to honor the knowledge, but not depend from it completely, just to find oneself.
I think the key word, if we're looking for an emotional attitude, let's say, that may have defined the life so far, I think it's the emotional quality of intense curiosity, first of all, intense curiosity. Since very, very early in my life, an intense curiosity that came with an intense frustration. In other words, I remember from around the age of 3 feeling very strongly that I had landed in the wrong place at the wrong time and was surrounded by people who had somehow been infected with a disease that gave them a very partial and cement-like belief structure. And so I felt tremendous frustration at the age of 3 in Scotland that I couldn't leave this culture, this Scottish culture, this Christian culture that I was surrounded with, that there was something wrong with it and that it had to be fixed, and that there was only one way for me to respond to that, which was to leave. And interestingly enough, the Scottish people, as far as I've been able to discover, have always been explorers and travelers on some kind of a quest, possibly because it's a country of very, very poor climate. Not much grows there. It's dark. It's brooding. It's the whole Celtic feel of it's a quiet energy, but at the same time, it's very frustrated and wants to move beyond itself. So that gave birth to curiosity in me. So I would say that frustration and curiosity came as an emotional set, a package, and I couldn't wait to leave this country. Unfortunately, you can't do that when you're 3 years old. And so I had to put up with the frustration for quite a long time until I was about 16, at which point I was able to make the first journey outside and to realize that my suspicions had been founded on some kind of a reality, which was there are many, many what I call reality tunnels on this planet. There are many, many different ways to appreciate reality. And traveling, in fact, pilgrimage, is probably one of the finest ways of discovering them.
I honestly cannot wait to jump into your documentary. And I'm trying to honor your life and exercise some self-control here. And share still some incredible, I would say, conflicting elements of your personal life. So pilgrims are coming, but your life is still here with us. Yes. And I'd like to make a comment. You actually being extremely successful in a standard sense of the world, standard sense of the word, in terms of economic success, professional success, actually political success, because you being part of Japan Council organization, and you worked as an investment consulting, you've been in a real estate business, you worked in an immigration consulting law, because I understand very few people could speak Japanese as well as you, and therefore you could help those people with their immigrational issues. So you've been extraordinarily successful. You've been part of this bubble of economy in Japan. You knew it all, as American expression goes. Mm. What particularly would you make connected to your childhood? In fact, I'm sorry, just to make a comment, when I learned about your 3 years old, almost like a secret revelation, mm. I didn't want to read about this. I wanted to hear it from you and give our listeners to have this precious, most incredibly powerful child realization coming from you yourself. Mm. Coming back to my statement about your mature realizations and mature actions as a business person, how this world connects to this profoundly, deeply complex and yet very transparent spiritual world of yours?
That's a very good question. A lot of what you have just described is in the relative field of success in the world. I have never really felt particularly successful for any long period of time because I've been through so many changes in my life. I feel that I have been graced, I have been lucky with certain things like you mentioned, Japan consultants. And to give a little bit of background on that, I am now sitting in the mountains of British Columbia as I talk to you. I had been in Japan for 15 straight years before that period of Japan consultants, which was not a period of business at all. It was a period of study. From 1974 until 1989, my principal activity was learning. First the language, then the practice and the study of Zen. Also, in association with that, the study and practice of martial arts and oriental medicine. These consumed the first 15 years of Japan. Meanwhile, I was raising a family. And so I had to work very hard to support them as a university lecturer, as an interpreter, as a translator, and as a private English tutor. These were my main jobs in Japan. So I was never really business-oriented at all, Lena. It just had to happen that way when I decided to leave Japan, which I did in 1989, feeling deeply frustrated by the incredible, what I would say is, a parochial mindset. Though I love the Japanese people, they are very insular. They're very xenophobic when it comes to being a foreigner in that culture. It's very difficult indeed. And so after 15 years, I found that even though I loved the old culture and I loved the philosophy and the religion, the reality of modern Japan is it's 99.9% pure Japanese conservative thinking. And so I had to leave. I said to myself, I'll do anything. I'll drive a taxi if I have to get out of here. And at that point, Canada opened her doors to me. And in order to be a landed immigrant in this culture, you have to set up a business. So without really wanting to become a businessman, I had to be. And it was sheer good fortune, luck, happenstance, serendipity, synchronicity, call it what you like. I happened to be at the right place at the right time, which was 1989 in Canada, when Japan was buying up real estate all over the world. They were purchasing skyscrapers in Manhattan. They were building resorts everywhere. And there was one thing they couldn't do. They couldn't speak English, and I could speak their language. And simply using that one very basic ability, no real estate knowledge, no training, no licenses, nothing, just because I could communicate in that language and I knew how to be with people from that culture, I was able to build an incredibly successful business for an incredibly short period of time. So it was short-lived success that crashed and burned completely with the collapse of the Japanese bubble economy, and that is what led to the aforementioned experience in 1992 that lay behind this name that nobody can pronounce, Ehan Deravi, which I guarantee there is not another person on the planet called this. So I don't feel that I've been particularly successful, though I've done many things. I feel that I've simply been graced with being at the right time in the right place, which is the synchronicity that the pilgrim must always be highly aware of. So the result of the business was I realized that business is not really my principal aim in this life. It was for my family. It was for immigration, and it was very helpful. But the demise of the business is what really started the period of activity that we're going to be focusing on today. It all happened from the great crash and burn of the Japanese economy in 1991, 1992, which it has never really recovered from. So I hope that helps you to understand that business was a very small part of this whole development. Although it stood out, although I was on national television for doing a project with the Japanese and all of that, it wasn't because I had a great talent. I was just lucky.
Well, you're simplifying it a little bit, but I would say that perhaps it's coupled with your intuition. And another most powerful language you have in addition to Japanese and English, which is not too bad, it's your human language. It's just like music, very universal. And may I permit the airtime to have a little pause here, since we accomplished somewhat a first segment of your remarkable life, and I hope we did set the tone with your persona and your environment. I'd like to reflect on this with a piece of music, which usually written for my shows, and I'm so grateful to very talented Julian Lampert. We're going to listen to his piece of music, which was actually written for this very particular show, and I hope we all will enjoy that. I know we had a little pause, we had a little technical discrepancy here, so I heard music a little earlier than Han, you did, and other listeners did, but I hope that we still got some taste, and on this I like to go on with your life before we will go into your documentary.
Yes, thank you, Lina.
Still quite fascinated by your ability, and I would say your instinct of playing this incredibly harmonious symphony between objective real world and this incredible bottomless spirituality. With your one quality which I personally tremendously admire is curiosity. I think with the curiosity, we have no limits. I think with the curiosity, we can conquer so many invisible obstacles. And you certainly did. You did something which you didn't even notice you've been doing. And to have a successful business, I'm sure many people can envy you. But you could do that because you've been free of this material success. You've been aiming for these answers and success with your spirit rather than with your money. I'm not sure if I put it in a way you will agree.
I agree.
Well, then if you are, I will follow on that. And I would say that you've been connected to extremely successful people. You had numbers of interviews. And I just will mention a few. Of course, Deepak Chopra is known to all of us. I happen to know, even though I'm a musician and I'm an educator, but I happen to know the name of Fred Allen Wolf, who is a brilliant physicist with his book of Parallel Universe. I'd like to ask you how those concrete scientific understanding of physics and perhaps some other stratospheric laws help or maybe nourish your internal world?
I never had a very strong science background when I was at school. I attended one of the most ancient schools, I believe, in the world. My school, Aberdeen Grammar School, was founded in the 13th century, if you can believe that. A very ancient school with very old traditions, of course, very academic. But I went the direction of art rather than science. And it was only this driving curiosity that pulled me back towards the scientific paradigm, because I realized if you're going to be a communicator, especially in Japan, where they have a very left-brained educational system indeed, many people might misunderstand, thinking, well, they're oriental, it's the five elements, it's the yin-yang philosophy, it's the emptiness of Buddhist consciousness. Almost none of that is in evidence in contemporary Japan. It's extremely left-brained and materialistic. And if you do not have an understanding of leading-edge science, and you're going to talk to people about something as difficult as consciousness research, then you're not going to get very far. You're going to have quotes from people like Fred Allen Wolf, who have a very unique and specific and, I would say, very evolved understanding of the place of physics in the understanding of consciousness, because we do live in a physical world. It was for that reason that from an early point in my career as an interviewer and a writer, I went after people like Deepak Chopra, who himself in the early days was using a lot of quantum physics to help people to understand something like consciousness. In other words, physics was a step that people could get up on to peep through something that was a little bit higher on the scale. Without it, it would be very difficult for me and for many other people like Fred and like Deepak Chopra. And earlier on, I had met the writer of the Tao of Physics, Fritjof Capra, at the very beginning of my writing career. And of course, he was one of the major scientists to link Oriental philosophy with quantum physics. So I'm in no way an expert in physics and would never pretend to be. But what I found in these people, especially in the physicists, was an openness to talking about issues of consciousness that perhaps other scientists weren't quite so ready to discuss, simply because quantum physics takes you right out there. And you have to, sooner or later, look into the whole issue of consciousness. So even today, in fact, as we'll perhaps discuss later, I included a physicist in the documentary, Nassim Haramein, for that reason, because so many of us find science to be the bedrock of our reality, and it cannot be discounted. It's great value, but I also see, of course, tremendous limitations in the current scientific model. So I suppose it was balance I was after by including it in my agenda.
I will include in your group of scientists and Einstein. I'm sure you have your vision of his vision of the world. I particularly can relate to a number of his sayings because he was a violinist and quite accomplished one. But I think he had a tremendous ability to connect with concrete physical science to the universe as a whole. There is something mentioned in your documentary, but I would not put my life on this, but something said that he felt that resolution of problems of the world is going back to the source of the world. Something like that. Could you comment and correct me?
A violinist. You mentioned a violinist. Was he a scientist?
No, we're talking about Albert Einstein.
Oh, we're talking about Einstein. Okay, sorry, I missed that part. And so, again, your question was?
My question was that there's something in your documentary. And as I said, I'm not...
Yes. Einstein Einstein briefly makes an appearance in our documentary. That's correct. We managed to get some archival footage of Einstein, which was actually quite expensive, black and white archival footage of Einstein.
Yes, and, that was the only familiar face I found in your documentary.
That's right. And, you know, Einstein was in there because, of course, we all know what a brilliant scientist he was, but many of us forget that he was an incredibly spiritual individual also. And anybody can get on the internet and they can look up the quotations of Albert Einstein and find very, very rich material there for contemplation. He understood, I think, that the human imagination is the single most important asset that we possess, whether we're scientists or philosophers or the ordinary man and woman in the street. The power of the imagination is far greater than the power of logic. And when you consider that science, as we know it today, grew out of what is called alchemy, then you understand that the alchemists were always saying the same thing about the imagination. The human imagination is the key to everything that we could possibly want to achieve or attain. And that's kind of been lost in recent decades. Imagination has been, I would say, downgraded to a simple tool to achieve short-term ends. I think the real reason for having imagination in the human psychology is to try to grasp the ungraspable, to attain an understanding of that which cannot really be understood, that which is behind consciousness, that which is consciousness itself. We cannot really understand it at an intellectual level. Otherwise, we'd have a definition for consciousness, and we don't. But scientists like Einstein were getting very, very, very close. And I can't remember, to be honest, the specific quote in Earth Pilgrims that he was related to, but I'm very happy that we did manage to purchase that 3 or 4 seconds of his smiling and rather cheeky face.
I do not want to take much time away from your documentary and yourself, but I just wanted to interject this incredibly sensitive point you made, which played probably the most crucial role in my own personal development. Because, you know, in the younger age, especially if you're in a competitive, high-quality education system, you compare how much you know, how much you don't know. And that imagination thought, fortunately, came across to my mind because, indeed, Einstein was a musician. And when I read about his biography and I came to understand this incredible conviction of his, my goodness, he created such a relief on me. It was such a breath of spiritual, intellectual, and musical air in me. I'm so grateful for that approach, for that philosophy. And of course, when we're talking about children, this imagination is such a moving force. And I think making a bridge to your documentary, I would say that indeed imagination is one of the most precious qualities we need to preserve. It's very powerful, and yet it's very vulnerable. I hope that on this note we will make an opening to your documentary, unless, Ehan, you want to bring some other important points of your life.
Actually, I have just remembered why Einstein was in the film, Lena, and that will help us, I think, to bridge ourselves to the next part of our discussion. Einstein's quote, and the reason he was in the film, was very fundamentally important. Einstein said, now these are not his exact words, I'm not quoting verbatim, but this is what he meant. He said, any problem that you have, whether it be financial, spiritual, emotional, or a concrete problem you have right in front of your face right now, whatever the problem is, you can never actually solve that problem using the same mindset or the same consciousness that created the problem. In other words, you have to rise above the problem to a literal different dimension of understanding. It is only there that you will find that the problem has actually ceased to exist. In other words, Einstein was saying only a transformation of consciousness itself will allow the problem to be overcome. And what we're doing today in the world, we're battling against economic problems using economic theory and economic brains and economic paradigms, and nothing is being solved, obviously. Environmentally, we're using the same techniques. Environmental issues are handled by environmentalists using environmental intellectual debating tools, and that's not solving the environmental problem. And you take it to any level, health, emotion, spiritual understanding. We must rise above the problem by changing our consciousness itself. And that leads into Earth Pilgrims, because Earth Pilgrims is not a documentary about how we're going to save and rescue the world from its problems. Not at all. It's a documentary suggesting that each one of us can, in fact, go through a transformative process in our own consciousness, which will literally take us beyond the problem to a new level of reality and understanding, where it no longer exists and disturbs us, and that perhaps at this very, very tricky point in our journey as human beings on this planet, when we're faced with what seems like insurmountable problems in every direction, it's time for us to turn the lens back upon ourselves and ask ourselves who we really are, what consciousness really is, and what is going on in this part of the galaxy. That's why Einstein was there, because he was the only scientist I could find who was talking about changing consciousness as a way of solving problems, not battling with them on the drawing board of third-dimensional reality.
And it is extremely complex, inflammatory process, and I like to introduce another piece of music which will introduce this, I would say, highly emotionally charged transformation, realization, and evolution, which each individual going through in their own rights. And after this piece of music, we will go right into your documentary. I hope that this music will be, even though somewhat very dramatic, but it will bring us to the very transparent, peaceful ending, which will be a nice overture to introduce your documentary. The piece of music again by the same composer, Julian Lampert, and it's called Entropy. And just to comment on this music, to give out a little secret, that was written just for one voice. That's only one human voice. And the reason I chose this piece of music, because perhaps it can illustrate how much one individual can experience, what a power of emotions, what kind of orbits of tremendous transformation one can go through. Drama and an incredible searching. On this note, I like to open my description, overall description, to your documentary. I had a very sudden thought immediately, actually, after I finished watching your documentary. It's a dream. Again, piece of imagination. I was hoping that perhaps every movie theater of the world will be closed for all movies. And simultaneously, at the same time, they will be showing just your documentary.
Oh, wonderful. I've waited a long time to hear that, Lena.
Well, I'm so thrilled that I found such an agreeable response. The other thing I need to share with you and to confess, I was watching your documentary two times. Mm. Once in a usual way, meaning that I just was watching it from the beginning to the end. But the second time, I was watching it without the sound.
Ah.
And that was most incredible impact.
Wow.
Because the way you made it just exercised, I take this back, it sounds too mechanical, too aerobic. It gave a birth and it nourished all our beautiful senses. We do not need necessarily to hear sometimes. Mm. And we do not need necessarily to see sometimes. Mm. But if we feel, and if we open to another dimension, which actually Albert Einstein was talking about in his own beautiful wisdom, we can focus on what is given to us and to be so grateful. Your documentary is a symphony of colors. It's dance of religion in the most beautiful way. It is a, not only a celebration of life just to have another wonderful party, but it is a profound statement of most incredible alliance between human nature, between real people, not just the people who are living in their shelters, in their humanitarian environment. It's open to everyone who wants to celebrate life, who wants to kiss the trees, who wants to dance with the grass, who wants to make feel that a stranger becoming part of his human family. I can certainly go on and on with the description of your documentary, overcoming somewhat limitations of the radio because we cannot see it. But I hope that my enthusiasm will resonate with other people, and whoever will hear this program, and all of my friends whom I already told about your documentary, will be exposed to the huge world, not a big world, but to the huge world. Please, Ehan, you are on with your creation, with your incredible statement for all of us.
Well, that is indeed encouraging, very encouraging. The film is largely unknown at this stage, and until now, I have been showing it in its Japanese version, because until 2 weeks ago, I was living in Japan. And I most certainly did not get a response like this, which you have just described to me so poetically and clearly. I did not get that response when the film was shown in Japan, I believe because a film about pilgrimage and about the pilgrim spirit, if we could call it that, is a very difficult issue for people who live and have lived in an established agrarian culture for so long. In other words, simply put, showing a nomadic message to a farming community with a long history of conservative staying in one place mentality, even in the 21st century, was on my part, I believe, perhaps short-sighted. It was too much of a leap for the people in Japan, too much of a jump to enter the territory that I was speaking about through the characters who stood on the stage of that film. So to be very honest with you, the response so far to this documentary has been extremely small. And although people politely will say to me in Japan, very interesting, I don't think that it penetrated their hearts. I was very glad to hear that you'd watched it twice, and I was really warmed by the fact that you went as far as to turn the sound off. How many people are willing to do that? So I haven't received the kind of feedback that you have been so kind enough to offer, and I hope that through our discussion today, we can get more people interested in the message of the film, which I believe to be timely, and move this message, which I believe is beyond nationality and religion and borders, and we all harbor a pilgrim inside our souls somewhere. If we can get this message out, then perhaps, as Einstein suggested, we can leap to another level of understanding rather than fight our way through the forest of problems that we currently have. So I'm deeply honored to hear such feedback. It's the first time. Really?
Well, I'm deeply moved that I could find a place for your self-rewarding appreciation, because you not only deserve that, but frankly, it's a very heroic statement you made today. And frankly, I'm not surprised that Japanese society was not so receptive, because for your own definition, it is so calculated, it's so material, and it is really a big link between their own history, their own sensitivity to their own cultural perception, and suddenly such a burst of emotional message. Mm-hmm. It's a great conflict in society. Frankly, I will share with you something which I found very unusual. They used to build every concert hall in every possible big city. Whether they have many concerts or very few concerts, but the hall will be built. Mm. So it is a statement in one sense, but the purpose of it, why to do this? It's almost like to say, well, I have one Chanel bag. I don't appreciate this enough. Well, I have, I like to have 10 more. Would I appreciate this 10 more? I'm not sure. So they are generous in somewhat their superficial curiosity, if I may say. But to have this incredible grasp of your message, I think that requires, number one, repetition. It requires exposure. And if I personally can do anything to promote your film on a spiritual way, not in a marketing way, because I tell you, I need this help myself. But in any way, if I can contribute to this incredible statement you made, you have another person on your board, and I'm sure that the other person who appreciates this very, very deeply is your family.
Could you tell us a little bit about your wife and about your two sons and your daughter, I understand?
My wife is an unusual Japanese. Your comments, by the way, on Japan were very interesting. Many people have a fixed image of Japan as this oriental culture with great beauty and elegance and an aesthetic sense that's highly polished and emotional sensitivity. All of this is true to a certain extent. My wife is a product of that culture. She was born in Osaka. But what made her very different from the culture that she came from was her own curiosity, her own rebellion against the treatment of women in her culture, which is still incredibly paternalistic. To this day, there are literally millions of extremely talented, wonderful women in that culture who have been pushed off the conveyor belt of marriage and family simply because of their age, who don't see any other possibility in life anymore than to simply go shopping. The shopping culture mentality and psychology that is so rampant in Japan now has almost completely hijacked every last vestige of spirituality that existed. And all of this has happened in the mere span of 50 or 60 years since the Americanization, the Westernization of the culture began. So she represents in her DNA a very ancient connection to a samurai lineage that's still working. She was very able in English from an early age because she loved the Beatles. And so this propelled her on her own quest, making her the first Japanese exchange student ever in Denmark at the age of 17. That was her first foray into the outside world. And then she went to live in London to study art, and she lived there for several years. And it was after that, when I was on one of my journeys to South America, that we met in Vancouver. And I found a kindred spirit, somebody from an entirely different culture. I mean, this was the Celtic and the samurai mix, the extreme East and the extreme West. That was such a powerful combination in terms of the children that it birthed. And you asked about my children, one of whom is downstairs with my grandchild right now, my daughter Masa, two sons, Kai and Tao, who are now in the late 20s, early 30s, what I would like to say about them is that they are a new kind of, I would call, transcultural being, because they contain the elements of the extreme Far East and the extreme Far West in their DNA. They neither belong to Japan completely or to the European tradition that their father came from, to Scotland, and later the Canadian tradition that they were introduced to. They don't really feel, I am totally from this place. And we're finding that more and more of these Asian-European blends are becoming adults who are closer to the pilgrim spirit, I would say, because they're not fixated in either tradition. In Japan, they used to call them, to my annoyance, they used to call them halves. They would see my children, they go, oh, you have a half there. In other words, half Japanese, half Scottish. And I would always get very annoyed and say, no, they're not half. They are double. They contain both the East and the West in their cultural, in their genetic programming, let's say. And so from that point of view, I was one of the early pioneers of international marriage in Japan. In the early 1970s, it was almost unheard of. And we were the pioneers of a whole new breed of transcultural children that we're now seeing many, many more of. And they're developing themselves in all different ways around the world. We're seeing that they're becoming successful in very diverse fields. And I believe that that success, which is not necessarily materialistic at all, comes from the fact that they have a real blend of what would be considered in the old days opposing cultures, but they're not opposing at all. They may be polar cultures, but like the yin and the yang, they have really served each other well. So I consider my meeting with Japan, my meeting with my wife, who is the soul of Japan, and the resulting children, to be the greatest gift that that culture could ever have given me, and has propelled me thus far in my life. But now I have left Japan. It is now time for me to return to Western culture, to communicating here, and to be talking to people like yourself, Lena, who I am astonished by, quite honestly, your incredible grasp of so many issues. We've never met, we've never talked before, but your very in-depth understanding of what I'm trying to communicate, obviously coming from probably a very good education to begin with, and many other issues, I'm sure, that came along with that, where you were born, your own culture, all of that. But I'm just delighted to see that here in the West we can have discussions like this at a very deep level, something that is difficult to do in Japan, even through the main media. I would say especially through the main media. I tried television, but it didn't work. So my family are spread between two cultures. However, very interesting timing that you asked this question. For the first time in over a decade, by next week, I will have my entire family in the same country, which will be Canada. Usually we're spread around. So we're a new kind of family, I think, in that sense. And we're pilgrims. We're always moving.
Well, especially for that segment of your sharing, I'm so profoundly thankful, and it is truly unexpected, more than joy, for me to discover such a dialogue which goes way beyond just a dialogue. It is that penetrating exchange, which I would say rare in any place in the world. And I am very thankful and certainly have a much more sense of faith at this moment, which you did mention in your point of journey, that you did find a face. So not to that extent, but I'm certainly grateful to my modest piece of faith, meeting you, having heard about your life and the children. And since we still have some time, I like to introduce another piece of music, which was indeed dedicated to children. After all, it is a future generation, as we all know. But particularly in your case, this is such a multi-dimensional children camp you have. And I hope we will have many more of such a free-thinking group of people who will be just as generously sharing their thoughts and their soul, just like yourself. So this piece of music, again, belongs to Julian Lambert, and he called it Child's Meditation. Thank you. coming back to your documentary, I was particularly deeply moved by few guests or their not really characters because they play themselves.
Mm.
There is ladies, forgive me, I forgot her name. I was
Miss
just...
Pilgrim.
Yes, she is. Wow. You know, I'm going to be very cynical to the point of vulgarity. Because this woman was so young, so vibrant, almost with excessive energy. And yet she had beautiful gray hair. And if someone will ask me how old is she, I certainly would say she's older than 40. Mm. And yet if you will put her in any regular television show, she will blow any of these young blondes away from the stage.
Indeed.
Because she just was, I would say she was suspiciously young. I wonder what is her vitamin. And I guess the secret is very open to everyone to be a pilgrim.
Yes.
I could not enough comprehend how I could find such a privilege in modern world today where exhaustion of human mind and emotion came to the extreme. Suddenly, this is burst of beautiful nature. And her words about life, that she said, I have nothing. And yet, she transmitted this tremendous wealth of her unrestricted spirit. And that were not just words. It were not just a fancy phrases. It was not a preaching. It was her own vision and her own feeling and her own committing to the world.
I'm very honored that we finally managed to get that footage. To some people, she is well known, but especially in Japan, I don't think anybody had ever heard of this woman who called herself simply Peace Pilgrim. And her story, very simply, is that actually around about the age of 40, as a very typical American suburban housewife, living in the 60s when we were all threatened with this horrible shadow of nuclear war, the Cuban Missile Crisis, all of that was happening. The Vietnam War was starting after that. And she asked herself, what is peace really all about? And what can I do to achieve something like peace during my lifetime and help others to achieve it? Her answer to that question, which many people have, of course, every day people ask themselves, I'm sure, how can we become a more peaceful world? Maybe we can create stronger missile defense systems to make ourselves peaceful, which, of course, is an absurdity. Peace is a state of mind. And she made the astonishing decision, I am going to leave this house, leave this marriage, leave this society, leave this system, leave everything. And I am going to become a pilgrim. I'm going to walk until I die through every state of this nation, the United States. And all I'm going to do is to try to live as a peaceful person and to communicate to other people what that peace means to me. I will take no money. I will have no possessions. I will walk until I am given shelter. I will sleep outside until I am given shelter. I will fast until I am given food, and I will not ask for it. This is how I will live my life until I die. Now, you can imagine, Lena, as a woman in the 1960s, and she was a very attractive woman, even as you said, as an older woman, and what you were seeing was actually Peace Pilgrim in her early 70s. When she was 30 years younger than that, she must have been an astonishingly attractive, vibrant human being. And there she was, with no money, no protection at all, walking alone through American cities and along American highways, you can appreciate how dangerous that must have been. And the fact that she was never physically attacked by any man on that road says something to the astonishing power of her consciousness itself. And so I chose her because of my deep respect for her heroism, her vision, and her saint-like qualities that she developed over the years, just walking around America. And also because I had some very powerful men in this documentary, very strong male characters, and they needed a balance. And I realized that there were two ways I could balance the strong male energy in the film. One was to have a superbly powerful woman like her in it, and also to have the poetry of Rumi in it, which has a very strong feminine quality within it also. But it was her presence in the film that I really wanted, and because there is very little archival footage of her actually at all, and it's all owned by the Friends of Peace Pilgrim, I spent a year negotiating for the rights to have her in this film, and finally succeeded. And actually, you're the first person to have actually shared your enthusiasm about her with me. So I'm extremely happy to hear that. She was a saint of the American highways and byways. She walked her talk. She was a true pilgrim. And that's why Peace Pilgrim is in Earth Pilgrims.
Incredible. So remarkable. I like to point a few episodes which you yourself shared in the documentary. Regardless of your frustration, I believe you've been in Jerusalem. I believe you've been in some other place of the world, and you've been hoping to find certain justification for some quality of emotions in life, but you found some disappointments, frustration, and I believe Jerusalem was one of those places. Can you comment just generally in your own searching and your own journey? How did you find the world?
The documentary itself was a pilgrimage. I did not start with a budget. I did not start with funding. I did not start with a script at all, which is what one normally would do to make a documentary. I simply picked up a small camera and headed off on a pilgrimage. I began the pilgrimage in my own culture on the island of Iona, which did not appear in the documentary because the quality of my own filmmaking was so terrible, it was unwatchable. But I did start the pilgrimage on the island of Iona, the sacred island of the Celts. And from there, I went to England to interview Graham Hancock and Satish Kumar. But right after that, I took the pilgrimage to Jerusalem for a very simple reason. It is the pilgrimage capital of the world. I think it is even beyond Mecca in that it represents three faiths. You have Judaism, you have Christianity, and of course you have Islam, all represented in Jerusalem. So it is the number one pilgrimage center of this planet, unquestionably so. It actually has a strong economic input from pilgrims coming from all over the world. And as I speak, there are people from the three faiths right there, right now, visiting holy spots. So I thought, if I go to Jerusalem, perhaps I can learn something really profound about this tradition of pilgrimage that this city represents. But when I got there, I discovered to my horror that actually the pilgrimage tradition has, like anything else, a negative side. It does have a dark side. It has its own shadow. And that shadow is the shadow of division between faiths. But more than that, it's the shadow that surrounds the idea that this is my sacred place. This is my sacred area. my sacred temple or my sacred church or my sacred mosque. And when that comes into the pilgrimage picture, in other words, when pilgrims stop moving and when they begin to revere a particular place or a particular icon or a particular person, then pilgrimage starts to go astray. And you end up with a fortified city full of division, where the message of the pilgrimage itself is almost entirely subsumed by the imagery that people create around their own sacred place. And thus the purpose of pilgrimage is defeated as the holy gather in their favorite spots, which may not be mine or yours. And that's why we end up with a literal wall around the city of Jerusalem. It is a walled place. And walls have nothing to do with pilgrimages. So my time there was, in that sense, frustrating. Though I love the land, I love the people, I had many wonderful experiences there. But from the point of view of a pilgrimage, I found that it was in Peru where I was to discover a much freer spirit of pilgrimage that had no ownership associated with it, because the object of the pilgrimage was not a temple or a shrine or a church or a mosque. It was nature herself. And that's where the pilgrimage really opened up, I felt.
Coming, sadly, to the crown of our program, which is the end, I wanted to ask you this tremendously magnificent festival. I guess it consists of 60,000 of pilgrims. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Approximately 60,000 pilgrims showed up at that festival in Earth Pilgrims, yes.
That was truly incredible pictures, and your cinematography was anything but suggesting a very small camera. It was, I'm sure it was much more sophisticated equipment. But more importantly, I felt I truly was there. The customs, choreography of dance. I think any greatest theaters in the world, like Bolshoi in Russia or Metropolitan in New York, would love to have one of those ensembles. What a sad disconnection that is between highly civilized and highly human expression in this festival and our highly restricted, very professional, but very limited in emotional perception events. Mm. I just hope that we can somehow start to connect ourselves with ourselves, because it is inevitable, because the voices in your documentary suggest somewhat a bit of scary, catastrophic consequences if humanity will not wake up. I'm trying to end up in a noble philosophical note. We have a dialectic. And in dialectic, we have death and life. And life is inevitably takes place of something which died. I hope that right now the world is catching up with overwhelming mechanical development, which perhaps unavoidable to experience with the technology, military, computer, and obedience of human brain is somewhat unavoidable. But it is so unnatural. So I feel it will be inevitably created by human death, which will provoke and provide the next step for true human life. And I do not want to have a last word on this. I like to have your conclusion, after which we will say, hopefully temporarily, goodbye. And if you like to contact, to leave a contact on the air so some people can either watch the documentary or find a way to find you. And your actually new book, we just didn't have time for that. But if you want to leave any kind of a form of contact, this is the time to do so, and I will be very happy to give you this opportunity.
Thank you very much indeed, Lina. The festival of Koyuriti has to be seen to be experienced, and that's why we put it on film. 60,000 native pilgrims from all over Peru going up to 16,000 feet to sing and to dance for 3 days in minus 10 degrees temperatures some of the time. That was something extraordinary to be part of, and it was filmed very professionally, actually, not by myself, of course, but by a good Israeli cinematographer by the name of Amnon Zalat, and the quality of his filming, I think, was best throughout the documentary. There is no conclusion to any documentary or philosophy of pilgrimage, because the road goes ever on. And if we boil down this documentary to a centrally important theme, it is the theme of evolution. And evolution itself is an ongoing unfolding of consciousness itself that, as far as I can see, has no end. So the pilgrimage will go on. And in my case, it has led me to Canada. It has led me to re-adopting my birth name of John Craig. Ehan Deravi's period of activity was from 1992 to 2010, and his activity was principally through my work in Japan. But now I have returned to the West. Ehan Deravi still lives and breathes in me, but I have a new incarnation now, a new work to do as John Craig, my birth name. And I'm writing a book called Japanthropologist. If you add the two words Japan and anthropologist, you get an idea of what it might be about. It's about my experience in Japan and about the whole issue of evolution and transformation in our age. It's going to be a novel rather than the 25 books of nonfiction I've already put out in Japanese. So you can find the information about the film at earthpilgrims.com. You can find at least all of the Peru section is being shown for free on the internet, so that anybody can go and check that out through earthpilgrims.com website. Josh East has been very helpful in spreading the message for us here in the West. That's how we connected with you, so we must thank Josh for making that connection. He's beginning to get us on the International Movie Database. He's got us on video on demand at Amazon, and he's going to get us more interviews to talk about the film. Japanthropologist.com, if we can spell it, Japanthropologist.com will show what John Craig is up to. I'll be starting lecture tours here in Canada, and I'll be showing Earth Pilgrims in as many locations as possible. I'm very open to suggestions from anybody who might want to show the film and have a discussion and maybe a question and answer, talk event. I'm very interested in doing that now that I'm located back in the West and I can speak English instead of doing everything in Japanese. It's just marvelous to be able to communicate in my own language. I'm sure you understand that, Lena. Your English is, by the way, incredibly succinct, as only somebody from your part of the world can speak it, so much more defined than the so-called native speakers. So anybody wants to know any more can go to those websites, and hope we can connect more. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, thank you. Thank you for such a generously warm description of my English, but I will rush to the dictionary to learn exactly what you said about me.
What was the name of the place you were born? Can I ask?
Absolutely. You do not need to go to the dictionary. That was Moscow. Exactly.
Wow.
And you, I understand, being there because somehow with all your orbits connections, you did connect to Gorbachev's environment.
Well, actually, I didn't make it to Moscow. I think Russia made it to me. I met Gorbachev at the Green Cross inaugural ceremonies in Kyoto in 1993. He came to the Kyoto International Conference Center, and I ended up being the interpreter for his international press liaison team and had the most extraordinary experience of what I think people today are talking about in The Secret and other such philosophies. If you really want to something to happen, it does, but I think there's a condition attached. When I heard that Mikhail Gorbachev was coming to Kyoto, I simply and innocently had a strong feeling of, I would love to be in the same room as that man. That's all. And, you know, I imagined I would be in a room with 2,000 other people, but I actually physically ended up in a room with him alone, which is impossible. I mean, no bodyguards, no staff, nothing. Just me and him together in a room alone for approximately 2 minutes was a minor miracle in my life. And the 3 days that I spent with him convinced me that Russia had produced something extraordinary in his body of work and his thinking. And I did study Russian at school, by the way, for 1 year. So I love the language, I love the culture, but I never actually made it to Moscow. But now I'm connecting with you. And I thank you again, and I hope we can communicate more.
I'm more than looking forward to that, and my warmest thanks to your family, who I'm sure been such a backbone to your life, inspiration, extended your human power to give us a gift with your life, with your sometimes not very reachable but fantastic stratosphere of thinking, creation. I wish you a tremendous amount of tolerance for the something you don't like and tremendous strength for something which you adore, and I'm sure you have it. I'm looking very much forward to our next programs, and with my best wishes to your next step, next documentary, but mostly important with the incredible success of this documentary, which everyone should crave to see and to be a part of. I hope that with joint efforts, it will be heard, it would be felt, it will be admired, and it will be totally, completely, I would say, censured by the people of our society for the sake of the next generation.
That it be so. Thank you very much indeed.
On this note, we will say goodbye to our BBS station with a generosity of giving us extra time, which was so enjoyable. Incredible privilege to have this guest and a very special hero of our society whose bravery, talent, and inspiration makes tremendous difference in everybody's life. We will say goodbye to everyone, and I will say hello again to my next program, which is going to be tomorrow as an extra program. And I'm looking forward to that with my best. This is Lena Life with my show, and best wishes to all of you. Goodbye.